With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Susanna Constantine, and this is My Wardrobe Malfunction, the podcast that's perfect for the drawing in nights now that autumn is with us. This is a bonus episode and our 66th in total. And my guest today is someone very special to me, someone who I haven't seen in decades. It's Lady Glenconner, who was lady-in-waiting to Princess Margaret for more than 30 years and is now a best-selling author. So our background, we do have a background because I went out with Princess Margaret's son, David Linley, for a long time and I got to know Anne well during those years. So let's grab the handles, open my wardrobe doors and find out what's inside. Today, I am delighted to be with lady-in-waiting to Princess Margaret for more than 30 years, but even more staggeringly, she is a best-selling author and now heir to Agatha Christie with her two crime novels. I am with Lady Glenconner. Oh, Anne, I can't believe I'm seeing you. I feel quite emotional seeing you.
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled because we haven't seen each other quite a number of years. And I've got a photograph of us. I don't know if anybody can see it, but I'm showing it to you anyway. It was taken at Colin's peacock ball, and you're in a lovely pink dress, and Princess Margaret is in a sort of golden dress, and yeah. I'm in a blue dress. And I remember, and look at David, her son, David Linley, who was your boyfriend, I think, at that moment.
Exactly.
In an amazing sort of white peacock headdress.
God, that was such a night. Do you know what I remember about that night, Anne, is that I got so overexcited that night that I passed out. I don't know if you remember that. I passed clean out.
Well, where did you pass out? I hope not in the swimming pool.
No, I didn't. Luckily I was in the loo, and I remember, I think it was Jerry Hall came to help me, and she was so sweet, and I was like collapsed.
It was
just the excitement of the whole night. It was
the most amazing night. And do you remember the wonderful boat that we came to the Mustique on? And it had wonderful sails that went up to music, I remember. Anyway, it was lit overall and was sort of bobbing about just in front of the house. And the house was all lit up. And everybody looked fantastic, didn't they?
They really did. And I remember that boat so well. What was it called? The Sea Wind or something? Or Sea Star? Was it the Sea Star?
And it was the first of that sort of line. It was the most beautiful boat.
Beautiful.
I always remember talking about dresses. I remember Princess Margaret, because Colin had most of our dresses made in India. We went out on various trips to India. And I remember when Princess Margaret first saw her dress, she said, "I've been waiting all my life," she said, "for a dress like this. It really makes me feel like a proper princess."
Oh, my God. Do you know what? I miss her. I miss her so much.
So do I.
And the thing I loved about your book, Lady in Waiting, I've read all your books, but Lady in Waiting was the first one. And it was just such a relief to see someone who obviously was very close to her, but portrayed her in a way of how she was and how I remembered her as being funny, warm, loving, protective, all those things. She was like a second mum to me.
That really has inspired me to write the book partly. I won't mention names, but somebody wrote this horrible book about her.
I can remember his name, the absolute wanker, Craig Brown.
Absolutely right. Well, I didn't remember his name, but I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah.
And if I ever meet him, I'm going to say to him, I want to thank you very much, because if it wasn't for you, I would never have written Lady in Waiting. And I just wanted to put the record straight, because, I mean, you and I knew her. And we knew how wonderful. She's my best friend. I mean, she's a wonderful friend to me. And so, especially when Henry, you know, got AIDS and was ill, she was so supportive. And I miss her, because didn't you find that when you asked her a question, she answered it in a sort of way you didn't expect? She often came from things from a different angle. And I thought, I loved all that, you know. She was, I don't know why, I mean, she had a sort of, she had her royal moments. But then she was very royal. I mean, when she was a child, I mean, there were just the four of them, the king, the queen, Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret Rose. And half the world was pink.
Yeah.
I mean, her father was King Emperor.
Unbelievable, isn't it? Unbelievable. And she just seems so, I mean, I just remember her as being my boyfriend's mother. You know, that's the person I saw.
Well, yes, of course. And I mean, you knew her, I mean, I knew her perhaps in a slightly different way. But I mean, we were childhood friends. And she, because I'm sitting here in Norfolk talking to you, and I'm only about 12 miles from Sandringham. So she and the Queen used to come a lot to Holkham when I was a child. And Mrs. Margaret was such fun. I mean, we got up to quite a lot of mischief, actually. The Queen was sort of 6 years older and, you know, was always saying, oh, Margaret, you mustn't do that. And, oh, Anne, what are you doing? And Mrs. Margaret and I used to be on our tricycles, and sort of tricycle away with screams of laughter.
So I can just so imagine it. And you put that across so well in your book, and especially in your new book, which is coming out today. And I love that. I love the fact that it's, you know, haunting at Holkham. And I love the fact that it just really gives the reader a true insight into, A, how things were, but how, in so many ways, life in a big stately home was just unglamorous. And yes, you were in big surroundings, but it was very much the same as everybody else. You had... You know, you had the rations, you had, you know, you struggled.
Yes, I think people sort of don't remember for children how frightening it was. I mean, we thought Hitler was, especially here, we're only a mile from the coast, and actually Hitler had all his flat-bottom boats in Holland and Belgium and was going to invade England from here. Luckily, he went to Russia, so it didn't happen. But it was frightening, and there were coupons. And I mean, my coronation dress, when we talk about something that I sort of love, I mean, it was amazing when I went to Norman Hartnell. And there we were fitted with these fantastic dresses. The silk had come from silkworms in Wales, wow. Heavily embroidered. It was the most beautiful, wonderful dress I've ever had.
You've had the most extraordinary life. But what I find so incredible about you, Anne, is you're now having another extraordinary life. And, you know, the fact that you wrote Lady in Waiting and it became a massive success with over 200,000 copies sold, I think just in this country.
No, half a million.
I love you. Put me right. Half a million.
So that was what I wanted. I said, I didn't know anything about writing books. I said to my publisher, Hodder, I said, I got two goals. One is to sell over half a million, which I've done. And the other is to be on Graham Norton's Red Sofa. And both of which, she said, it's quite impossible. You won't achieve that. And I said, mark my words, or like Collins say, mark my words, I'm going to make Musty a household name. And I got on, and it turned out to be a great success. But now my book's it's being published in Russia, in Japan, all over the world. And one of the things I really didn't think I'm a sort of author. I'm an agony aunt author. Because people write to me from all over the world quite a lot about people who've lost children or people interested in, you know, the royal family. And, you know, and as you were saying a minute ago, the sort of upstairs, downstairs life, I lived at Holkham, you know, during the war. My last book, Haunting at Holkham, is about Lady Mary Campbell. She then became Lady Mary Cook. She refused, she's the daughter of the Duke and Duchess of Argyll, and refused to consummate her marriage, which in those days, marriages were all about producing an heir, especially in aristocratic families. And she refused that. So she was locked up in Holcombe. And this, eventually she was rescued by our mother. But this is her ghost. And she's very powerful at Holcombe. I mean, she's a pusher and a, you know, a pincher and leaves all the lights on. And well, people who read my book, Haunting in Holcombe, well, I write about exactly what she does, which is extraordinary, quite extraordinary.
And so that's not fiction. I wanted to ask you about how much is fiction in the book.
In fact, Haunting in Holcombe isn't really fiction at all. There's one story that runs through it about the necklace. That's the only story that isn't true. But all the characters are true. I changed their names. I mean, my horrible governess, I had everything I write in the book is absolutely true. In fact, it was even worse than what I wrote.
Really? She's called, what was she called? Mrs. Lavender?
Well, I could change her name. She wasn't called that. Exactly. Lavender Crane, Miss Lavender.
Yeah, Lavender, in the book.
I sort of gave her a sort of an unexpected, rather nice name, but to hide what she was really like. I mean, what was simply marvellous about writing, I found, is it's so therapeutic. I mean, I felt quite... I always kept all, because my parents weren't there, you know, and I thought my mother had engaged her just before they left for Egypt. And I thought my mother knew what she was doing to me, you know, like you do. And I didn't dare tell anybody. And I think probably a lot of other people who suffered abuse will, you know, when they read my book, will relate to it.
It's funny how the subject matters that you touch on are so contemporary. They happened, you know, decades ago, but they're still so contemporary. And that's what's amazing about what you're writing. People can relate to it, relate to your words, relate to the issues in a way, and it doesn't matter how old they are.
No, I mean, those sort of things, I think, does go on. And, you know, the number of people have lost children, and you never think you're going to lose your child. You know, you think you're going to die first. And so to have lost two, like I did, well, you knew them, Henry and Charlie, because they were at that party. And then for Christopher to have this appalling accident.
Awful.
And I had to cope with knowing two of my sons are going to die, and one that could have died. But I absolutely, with my lovely nanny who helped me look after the children, who then went on to look after William and Harry. She came back
Barbara.
And she came back to me for a year. She rang up and said, "Oh, Lady Glenconner, she just left William and Harry," and said, "I'd love to come and help you with Christopher." And she was brilliant. She thought of all sorts of ways that they hadn't thought about in the hospital, like he couldn't swallow. So one day she bought a baby's bottle. And the nurse said, "What are you doing, Miss Barnes, in this bottle?" And she said, "Can I just try it?" And she put it between his lips and sort of, and he began to suck and he swallowed. And we wrote, Barbara and I wrote an article for the Lancet about how as we as lay people felt, you know, what we could do with people in comas.
That's extraordinary. So from that, you must have seen, I mean, just that small thing kind of resulted in such a huge moment, because there was his will. You saw in the sucking his will to survive.
Yes, and I mean, he couldn't, well, he couldn't have had a life at all if he couldn't swallow, you know.
No.
So it's vital that we got him to swallow. And this is how we did it. And lots of other things we did, you know.
Yeah.
And Christopher is still quite badly disabled, but he's been married twice.
Amazing.
Yeah, he's got the most lovely second wife, Joanna, who helps me. She's now my PA. And he's got these two very clever daughters. One's got a first at King's the other day. The other one's probably will do the same. Fantastic. And he's never complained, Christopher. You know, and he always says, "Mum, it's much worse for you than for me." He said, I wouldn't change my life at all. I've had a different life, but he helps other people who have been in comas. And we work for Headway, which is a charity for people head injured. So, you know, I'm so lucky. And then Charlie and Henry each have a son. So I've got two wonderful grandsons. And you'd never guess that Charlie's son is a banker and a lawyer.
No, the antithesis of Charlie.
Well, I mean, Charlie would be absolutely amazed to know that his son was a banker. It always amuses me that. And then I've got two twins. One of them's married with two. But Henry would be a grandfather because Ewan has got, I've got two great-grandchildren, William and Ruby. Absolutely lovely. So I've got great-grandchildren from them. So I'm
amazing.
Really, really, and as you said, my life has completely changed. But I'm having a ball. I mean, I've never enjoyed having been what I call in the shadows, rather, especially with Colin, you know, who's ringmaster par excellence, and Princess Margaret, which, of course, that was my job, was to follow. So suddenly I'm out with a bang.
Amazing.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. And have you always loved writing?
I've always I dictated my books, you know, because aged 87 when they asked me, I could be 90 next year.
Unreal.
I just couldn't physically, so I dictate them. But I've always told stories. I mean the one on Mustique, I mean they're thinly disguised, the characters, you know, real people who live on Mustique, but and I've always longed, I've always adored Agatha Christie, and thought, you know, I'd be sort of slightly upmarket Agatha Christie. But I did have 12 years alone with Colin on Mustique, and it did cross my mind once or twice I might murder him, actually. So I had sort of, you know, thought about how I might do that. So it didn't exactly. I had, you know, but I've always told myself stories. Quite often, to get round difficult moments in my life, you know, I go off into a sort of, I tell myself a sort of fairy story. Really.
I so identify with that, because I do that when I can't sleep. I think about ways I could murder someone without getting caught, or how I would smuggle drugs into the country without getting caught. Those are two things I think about. I don't count sheep. I think about how I'm going to avoid jail.
They're much more interesting. Sheep are so boring. No, but I did. I've always told myself sort of stories. And of course, you've read in Haunting at Holkham, my governess does have a rather sticky end, shall we say. And that was something, even as a small child, I thought about, how can I murder her? How can I get rid of her? Anyway, it's all come very useful to me now, you know.
It's fantastic. And have you always been so determined? Because your life, you know, with everything that you've been through, you could have been crushed, but, you know, we've come to know you as this person with immense inner strength, but also this tremendous determination. Has that always been in you?
Yes, I think it has. Colin called it Norfolk obstinacy, but you only have one life. My life hasn't been very easy, but on the other hand, I've done amazing things, like being chosen for the coronation. I mean, goodness, I mean, fantastic. And Princess Margaret, I love my 34 years with her. And I love Colin, of course. I mean, it was very difficult. And he gave me the fantastic life in the end with Mustique. But I am quite determined, yes, I mean, to make the very best of my life and to enjoy it as much as I can. And I thought, well, I can't, when the boys are so ill, and then I had the twins, Christopher, and I couldn't be a weepy old sort of hopeless mother. I had to pull myself together and do. And the other thing, which isn't perhaps very fashionable to talk about, is I've got a great faith, a religious faith. And that has helped me more than anything. It really has. I mean, I've always been to church when I was young, and that sort of lip service one pays to pay. And it wasn't until the boys were dying, Christopher might have died, that I really started to, you know, have a very serious conversation with God, quite frankly. And
I'm not
going to lose Christopher.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, faith comes in many forms. And I mean, I have a very strong faith because, but not, I don't know if it's God per se, but I have a, what I call a higher power, because I'm in recovery because I'm an alcoholic. And so I go to AA and la, la, la. And I have a higher power. And I find it so comforting to know that I've got someone looking out for me. And it's kind of like, if I do the rowing, the outcome is in safe hands.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, you have to do a lot yourself. It has to come from you. But one's faith can support one. And in Lady in Waiting, I won't go into it now, but I did have one sort of minor miracle that...
Please tell me. Tell me what it was. Remind me.
Well, I had this wonderful Christian healer called Mrs. Black. She lived in Scotland. And when Christopher had his accident, I tried everything and went everywhere, I listened to everything. Anyway, I was told that she was a fantastic healer, and she was. And she used to come down once a month to see Christopher. When she's with him, she did extraordinary things. She got him to sit up. I mean, the doctors didn't particularly like her, but she was fantastic. And anyway, one day she used to ring me up to see how he was. And I was so tired one day, I just thought I'm going to die. I just feel. And she said, "Anne, you don't sound too good." And I said, "I'm not. I just think I'm going to die with tiredness." So she said, "Well, tomorrow morning, sit in a comfortable chair at 10 o'clock in the morning and don't think of anything. Just blank your mind, don't think of anything." So slightly like Doubting Thomas, I sat slightly embarrassed, hoping no one was coming. And 10 o'clock arrived. And it was extraordinary. It felt as if I was full of champagne and energy and hope and happiness. And it didn't last for very long. But all I can say was after that, I went back to the hospital. I went back and I had the energy to do everything for the boys again.
Amazing.
And it was, that's any time anything like that's happened to me. But it was my minor miracle.
But do you think, Anne, that came from Mrs. Black, or was she kind of thinking of you at the same time? Was she a healer, or was she?
Yeah, she's a healer. Spirit. Yeah. She. I think God came through her.
Okay. Oh, sorry, dogs. I'm so sorry. Yappy little. They'll probably keep barking. The postman's here. So I'll just wait for them to stop bloody barking.
Is a postman coming?
Yeah, the postman's just outside one of the doors and is posting, and then he'll drive away. I'm so sorry.
No. I mean, how much long? I mean, what?
Well, as long as you've got. I'm so happy talking to you.
It's so lovely actually to talk to somebody like you. Oh, I know, because I do these interviews, but I've never seen anybody before, or occasionally, Giles Bamworth or something like that.
Yeah.
It's so lovely. I was so pleased when you wanted. I mean, I thought you were going to ask about something that means a great deal to me.
Oh, I'm going to get onto that. I've got all my little questions lined
something
up.
Something about my comfort, but I've got them here to show you.
Brilliant.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Brilliant. Okay, so I want to go on to more clothing things, Anne. So the things which I find quite odd today, being nearly 60, I find it so extraordinary when people come to our house, and it's like the young, my children's friends, and my children always automatically take their shoes off before they come in. They all do that. And then people come here, and not so much friends, but people who are helping out, and they all say, can we take our shoes off? I was just thinking about that yesterday. I thought I'm going to ask Anne whether that's something that she comes across.
No.
No.
People don't do that.
Who makes me take my shoes off? Somewhere I did. But no, it's not. So, well, actually, yes, I know who do. And they're probably are my great-grandchildren. They, when they come, they say, Granny, should we take our shoes off? And I say, no, that's not necessary.
Don't worry about it.
So I imagine at home that they probably do. I mean, I do see if you're doing all the housework yourself, that to take your shoes off, I mean, does stop a lot of mud coming into the house, doesn't it?
I suppose, but I just find it, you know, there are things like that that I do find just kind of strange.
I know. I was, sadly, didn't come to anything because of COVID, but I was asked to speak at the Oxford Union. And I was really, really looking forward to that. I would have said, you know, it's a wonderful young audience, because on the whole, my audiences aren't very young. And I was going to say, you know, I expect you won't understand me, and I certainly don't understand you. So let's have a conversation. And I was going to tease a bit, you know, by not clapping and jazz hands and, and saying that, you know, my generation certainly was not brought up. I mean, we're not snowflakes, we're not work, we're, you know, and I find it very difficult to understand some of the things that they mind about. I really do.
No, I am 100% with you, and I get very frustrated. I could sit and, you know, give you a list as long as my arms of things that annoy me. And words, you have to be so careful. And it's kind of like my children who are not woke, or, you know, they are very, they're quite sort of feral, and they've grown up in the countryside, and, you know, they're fearless. And I love that about them. But they do worry. It's like, you know, if they've put something that's maybe a bit dodgy on Instagram, it's like my youngest daughter said, oh, my God, what if I go for a job, is this going to be found? I said, they feel they can't be themselves, and then there'll be contemporaries who will jump on a bandwagon and force their, you know, their friends or people at school, it's like shame them for not jumping on a bandwagon. And I think that's just appalling.
Yeah, well, I do too. I mean, you know, you read in the newspaper every day, you know, some footballer wouldn't bend the knee or whatever they have, and might have to leave. Well, I mean, surely you're allowed to do, you know, if you feel strongly about something, I don't see why you should be forced into it just because a whole lot of other people say so.
No, absolutely.
The words, I mean, when I'm writing, I'm quite sort of words I never think about. Oh, no, you can't use that, Lady Glenconner. You know, it's ridiculous, really.
So what, when that happens, do you go, I suppose you think it's ridiculous, but do you...
Well, I try and find some other word. I mean, sometimes I say, no, I'm not changing that, you know. I'm going to be 90, and they must expect something 90 to, you know, certain words. Sometimes when, I mean, I don't want to hurt people, embarrass people, or make people feel... You know, especially with black people. I mean, I was, spent so long in the Caribbean. We lived out there, and I got so many lovely friends out there. And, you know, you never thought about it. The minute you come back here, suddenly you have to be so careful, that was one of the things about Princess Margaret. I mean, she was adored out there, wasn't she, in the Caribbean?
Absolutely.
And she was so good with them all. She loved all the dancing to the steel bands. They always called her our princess, you know.
Yeah, no, it was wonderful.
At her funeral, I don't know whether you went. Did you go to her funeral? It was really sad. Colin didn't go. I was so surprised. He just said, I feel so emotional about it that I really, you know, don't want to break down in front of everybody. But afterwards, at the wake, one of the ladies in waiting said the Queen wanted to speak to me. And so I went, and it was lovely of her because, well, you know, especially as we introduced Princess Mark to Roddy, you know, I was so slightly awkward about it. But she said, and I want to thank you and tell Colin, how happy you made Margaret, with her house and everything. And also she said, she's so happy with Roddy Llewellyn as well. They were very nice, to thank us.
Yeah, very nice. I mean, they had such a close bond, didn't they? Those two, in such an unexpected way, and I don't want to go into it, but because that's something that's private, but they were both so different, but it didn't matter. They were so accepting of each other.
Exactly. And I think there's still 6 years difference in age. I mean, I remember when we were all children together, the Queen was always looking out for Princess Margaret. She was always seeing she's all right and all that. And Princess Margaret adored her sister.
Mm.
Was always very supportive.
No, it's a. I really wish so much she was still around. I really.
So do I.
I really, and for you especially.
Yeah, I was looking at more photographs of Colin's peacock ball, and it sort of brought back so many happy memories. It was a lovely week, wasn't it?
It was fantastic, and I remember the boat. We sailed all. We went to St. Lucia to Les Jolies Eaux. No, not Les Jolies Eaux. That's Princess Margaret's house. What was it called? Colin's. He was starting a new resort there between the.
Oh, you mean St. Lucia?
On St. Lucia, yeah.
Oh yes, Bang. Well, it was his. He had a restaurant there called Bang Between the Pitons.
Yeah, and then there was the elephant all dressed up.
The elephant. Do you remember on Bekwe, a little island, we all went to find these cutouts of various people that were hidden in the. And the Queen was sort of. The Queen's cutout was in a sort of jungle, and Princess Margaret, I can't remember. Princess Margaret, I think, was propping up a bar. So. But it was such fun. And we all whizzed round in different cars to find them all. And Colin gave us, the winners got a prize at the end.
I've still got the T-shirt from that, and it was called the Windstar.
Oh, the Windstar.
And I've still got, we all got a T-shirt, a striped sort of Breton T-shirt, and then with the Windstar written in red writing, and I still have that. I should have found it to show it to you. I still have it. Such happy memories.
Walk back, so many memories.
With your boys, Charlie and Henry, and all the difficult times, and then with Christopher, was there anything that gave you comfort, a sort of physical thing that gave you comfort, like a comfort blanket through those times?
Well, I always wore, I've got them here, for my wedding, my mother and father gave me three strings of pearls, there they are. And Colin gave me the clasp, which is an 18th century diamond button.
Wow.
You can probably see it there.
Well, that's a big diamond. That's like a pillow in the middle, rose cut.
Well, anyway, and I always wore them, partly because pearls should be worn, they fade, they need the human warmth. So that was my comfort.
Stunning.
Shall I just show you what the thing that sort of means the most?
Yes.
That is the hedgehog, and it's the only one that all the other girls, I think, have lost them. There may be one left, but that's what I wore
on the coronation.
On the coronation. I got my dress, which is slightly the worse for wear, because my father showed it at Holkham and it was in the sun. But this, I suppose, and the dress are the things that mean the most to me as far as sort of something to wear.
Like your birthday suit.
Mm. Such an incredible moment. I mean, I was so lucky to be chosen. We had to be daughters of earls, marquesses, or dukes. We had to be unmarried. We had to have sort of nice figures and all that sort of thing. But I was just so lucky I was the right age and came, all that. So that's what I...
So that headdress, can I just say, what's it made of? So this is the headdress that you wore at the coronation.
These are ears of corn. They're made of gold things. These are mother of pearl.
Yeah.
And there's ears of corn. And then there are there's little diamonds occasionally, and the flowers, there's leaves and various flowers here, and that was embroidered on our dresses too.
Who made that? Who made the headdress? Was that
Hartnell?
Okay, and is it made from real pearls and gold, or?
Well, no, I think probably not. There's real mother of pearl. There are leaves made of mother of pearl. There's a leaf made of mother of pearl. Yeah. But they were copied for her wedding when the Queen was married. Her bridesmaids had similar wreaths like that. And they looked lovely. You could see it, especially when we went on the balcony with the Queen. They also shone, the colour film. And they look really lovely.
Have you ever worn it?
I wore the
year of the coronation. There was a big ball at Buckingham Palace, and I did wear my coronation dress. That was the only time.
Any time. And what about the headdress?
No, I've never worn that. No, we didn't wear the headdress. But the dresses were very tight and boned, you know, like things were boned very much. And so it wasn't very comfortable. Partly why I think I didn't wear it again, but and it had quite a longish train too. So what was I didn't have much fun at the party because I was so busy stopping people walking on the train. But shall I tell you my malfunction?
Yeah. What's your worst wardrobe malfunction, Lady Clanconnor?
Well, it was just the other day. In fact, I was asked by the Duchess of Cornwall to represent her at a Thanksgiving service of a mutual friend up here in Norfolk. And the household sends you one or two things, like a wonderful crown that you're allowed to put on in front of your car when you're going to the church. And a little note saying, the family don't want you to wear black. So I thought, well, okay. And this lovely lady that died had admired once this very, very bright green silk jacket. So I thought, well, I'll wear the bright silk green jacket. And I didn't, at least I had a black hat. Well, when I arrived, there were quite a few members, actually, of the royal family there. To my absolute horror, they were all in navy blue or grey. And I stood out like an awful, sort of huge sort of pea, red. And so afterwards, I went up to one of Mary's daughters who was away. I said, look, I do apologise, but I was told not to wear black, but I thought, well, I overdone it, and I just wore this bright green silk jacket because Mary had admired it. So anyway, they were very polite and said, oh no, it doesn't matter.
Oh my goodness.
I could see the other members of the royal family thinking, what on earth is Anne wearing?
But you've always worn bright colours. I mean, you're not today. You're in a very sort of like country beige.
This is a lovely cashmere jersey. It's a bit chilly in here. And I do wear bright things. For my talks, I'm talking at Alexandra Palace next week, and then I'm going to Bath and Guildford and one or two other places. And I do wear bright because if you're on a stage, you know, they can see you. On the whole, I do wear quite bright things when I'm talking. And my talks, really, although they are about my books, but I engage with people very much. The only thing really useful that I learned when I went to a sort of finishing school was to learn public speaking. And we used to sit in class, and then I was called Anne Cook then. And Miss Neville Rose would say, Anne Cook, 5 minutes on the Firth of Forth Bridge. And you never knew what you were going to be asked, you know. And so up you got, and had to think on your feet. And actually, it's great, because I can project my voice and I can engage with people. When I'm talking, I make them laugh, actually. I mean, and they love all those sort of naughty stories about Colin. And, because Colin and Princess Margaret, you've got them in your book. But it's fantastic. You know?
You can't help but have fun, naughty stories.
You can't help without, exactly.
But was there ever a time in your life where you were shy?
Very, yes. You asked that in surprise. I was actually, when I was young, and when I came out, because I had no brothers, and you know, I'd always been to an all-girls school, and there weren't very many young men because they were all they were doing national service. Mm. So these dances, we all had cards to write in the different. And mine was generally empty. We always sort of write in pretend people and then rush off to the ladies' cloakroom and sit there because there just weren't very many men. And I was very shy. Yeah. I had this tremendous ball at Holcombe, really for my father and mother. They asked all their friends. And the king and queen came. It was white tie and medals. And Princess Margaret, she was lovely, she came. But I was absolutely so shy. I didn't really enjoy it, which is a shame. If I'd had the dance a year or two later, when I got to know some people, I would have enjoyed it. I mean, Colin came to my book, like, Coming Out Dance, and I never met him. Another 3 years.
So how do you think the sort of dressing of the royals has changed from your time to today?
I think it has changed quite a lot. For instance, I mean, they don't have ladies in waiting, the young ones. The Queen still has, and I think Princess Alexandra. I mean, it was more formal. I noticed that, I think it depended, really. I used to travel a lot with Princess Margaret. And I imagine the overseas tours probably are rather similar. I think that what has changed, I noticed that, say, Prince William and the Cambridges, I mean, they interact maybe more. When Prince Margaret did, but, it was all carefully staged. It was much more carefully staged. Now they're more relaxed, I think, and great. Mm. And I think from that point of view, it has changed. Mm. Princess Margaret, I think she was on one or two things. Was she in the Archers? I think she did have.
I think she was. Yes, no, she was. Yes.
I think, and she may have been in Coronation. But those were the only two things. Nowadays, they are on everything, aren't they? Oh. You'll see them talking. And they also write in the newspapers a lot, too, about various things that they feel very strongly about. Mm. I think it's relaxed, and I think it's great, I think.
Yeah.
And I do think the Cambridges are wonderful. I live very near them up here, and I think they're doing a fantastic job. I admire them very, very much. And, of course, love Prince Charles. I've always been. I knew him since he was five. He used to come here, stay with when he had mumps or measles, because the Queen had never been to boarding school. He's always sent to Holcombe, my mother, who's a lady in waiting. And he was like a sort of younger brother, really, to me and my sisters. And I still see quite a lot of him. He now comes to Sandringham. But I've got the greatest admiration for him. And he works so hard.
Mm. Yeah, I totally agree. He's a extraordinary person, and
Yes, and so much of what he said, and people used to laugh at talking to plants or whatever it was, and all the things he did. Well, I mean, climate change and things, he's banging on for years. Well, what he said, all has come true.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I think he's very remarkable.
Oh, Anne. Well, your book, The Haunting at Holcombe, comes out today. And everybody who's listening, I really urge you to read it because it's wonderfully nostalgic. It's quite, it's quite sinister too, in places. And your characters are so fabulous. And it's amazing to know that it's all true, apart from the necklace. I mean, I love that. Yeah, I'm going to have to reread it with that in mind.
I wore it for my wedding. And, of course, the book has got M papers of the park at Holcombe. So all the places that you can go and see now, there.
Wonderful.
And there's a map of the Holcombe room. Anyway, I'm so glad you liked it.
I really loved it. But who's living at Holcombe now?
My cousin. The eighth Earl of Leicester.
Okay.
Tom and Polly, they're lovely. They've got a young family.
Yes.
And they're doing great things at Holcombe. It's flourishing and it's really lovely.
Fantastic. Well, listen, I can't tell you how much it's meant to me seeing you and talking to you. And you really are an inspiration. And just keep on writing. Are you going to write more books? Haunting at Holkham can't be your last.
I think the next one, maybe by my last. Well, what they want me to do is really do more of a memoir. Because I have, of course, got lots more stories, yeah, which I wasn't able to put in Lady in Waiting. So I think if I can keep going, that will be probably my swan song. But it's been so lovely to see you. I was really looking forward to our talk. So I remember you all those years ago.
Amazing. And really, really fantastic. And I send you so much love and so much luck. And a big kiss from Sussex.
Well, a kiss from me. Lovely talking to you.
Thank you, Anne. What a truly extraordinary woman you are. That was such an emotional experience for me and brought back so many happy and fond memories. Lady Glenconner's new novel, A Haunting at Holkham, is out today and available in all good bookshops. There's a link to it in the show notes. You can also find us at My Ward Mal on our socials, on our website at mywardmal.com. And of course, subscribe, rate and review us on your chosen podcast platform. Finally, you can find our virtually royal house band, Duo, at duoguitarmusic.com or at Duo Guitar Music on their socials. That's it. Thank you so much again to Lady Glenconner. And please read her book. It is fabulous. To Duo, and of course, thanks to you for listening. Catch up soon. Until then, my wardrobe is officially closed.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.